All right, thank you. So this is my sabbatical year. So this is my regular affiliation, and I spent the summer in Paris, then 6 months in Oxford. So now I'm happy to have PI as my affiliation until this summer. Okay, so let me first describe the broad picture of where my talk lies. So this is just a sketch of early cosmic history, showing 1 plus the redshift down here, the age of the universe up there. So early on, it's the Big Bang. The universe was highly ionized and was hot and dense and highly ionized until cosmic recombination. At that point, most of the gas in the universe became atomic hydrogen. And here you had the so-called dark ages until the very first stars began to form. Now, initially, the stars formed in very small galaxies, but once you have stars, some of their UV radiation ionized some of the hydrogen in the surrounding neutral gas and hydrogen atoms. So you had the first H2 bubbles around galaxies, eventually larger galaxies formed with larger H2 bubbles. Then H2 bubbles of nearby galaxies began to overlap. And eventually, enough stars formed in the universe to fully reionize all of the low-density gas, the intergalactic gas in the universe. And that's the situation we have in the present universe. So in this talk, it will be divided into two parts. So part one is the high redshift end. So we're not talking about the very first stars, because the very first stars there's just a few of them. It's very hard to see how we will actually be able to observe them. But after a while, there was enough, the first significant population of stars, and we think that we'll be able to observe them, hopefully soon. And then part two will be about one idea, and there are now a number of interesting ideas of how processes that happened in very early times may leave some residues that we can see today in cosmological observations. Okay, so let's start with high redshift. So in high redshift, we think that 21 centimeter cosmology will be the main way to detect the first stars and their effect on the universe. So this refers to 21 centimeters is the wavelength that you get due to the spin-flip transition, also called the hyperfine splitting in the ground state of the hydrogen atom. So there's a tiny energy difference between the state where the proton and electron spins are parallel compared to where they're anti-parallel. Okay, so you get this long wavelength in the radio waves, corresponding frequency, this small energy, or measured in units of temperature. Now, in 21 centimeter cosmology, so of course we're interested in this because most of the universe was full of hydrogen atoms, most of the gas was. Now, we'd like to know the ratio of the abundance of the number of atoms in the excited state compared to the ground state of this transition. So this ratio, there's a factor of 3 due to the degeneracy factor of the spin 1 states. And then normally you would have a Boltzmann factor, e to the minus the energy difference in units of temperature divided by the gas temperature. Now in cosmology, we're at very low densities and things are normally not in thermal equilibrium. So normally this abundance ratio is not described by the regular or so-called kinetic gas temperature. So instead, we define an effective temperature, and that's called the spin temperature, which describes an effective temperature. It describes the abundance of the excited state of this hyperfine transition. So this spin temperature is what we'd like to know, because the relative abundance of these states is what determines when light passes through a cloud of hydrogen atoms. This abundance level determines how much light gets absorbed or how much if you get excess emission. So it determines what we actually observe. Okay, so before I continue, I want to briefly describe the history of this subject. So let's start with ancient history. So it's not so ancient. So reionization really began in earnest with this paper in 1965. So shortly after the first quasar was discovered, Gunn and Peterson realized that the fact that in the quasar spectrum we can see some light at energies above Lyman alpha, it means that not all the Lyman alpha was absorbed between us and the quasar, which means that between us and the quasar there aren't too many hydrogen atoms to absorb. So most of the atoms are, most of the hydrogen gas is ionized. And this began a lot of work and a lot of many, many different papers on how the universe became reionized. Now, 21st century cosmology is a younger subject, so it began with this paper in 1979 that worked out some of the basic ideas. So this was still early times. They were just looking very generally in terms of cosmological history. What can you detect with this? So if you can probe the density of hydrogen, its temperature, the spin temperature, if it's different from the regular kinetic temperature. In 1980, there was the next paper. So it was a similar idea, but now it was in the context of the modern cold dark matter model, which had developed. And here they also first mentioned that you can probe reionization with this, because of course, if you ionize some hydrogen atoms, then they disappear, they stop affecting 21 centimeter cosmology. However, the field was still very quiet until this paper in 97. So in this paper, they first considered what kind of signals might you be able to detect from galaxies at early times before cosmic reionization. And if you look at the common factor between these three papers in terms of the authors, you'll understand why in my recent visit to Cambridge, I made sure to come away with this souvenir. So Martin Rees, for those who don't know. Now, just to give you an idea of how this field developed. So in 2001, I wrote with Avi Loeb, maybe the first major review of this field in terms of the first stars and cosmic reionization. Now, this review was 114 pages in length. And out of them, a grand total of 3 pages were devoted to 21 centimeter cosmology. So in 2001, this was still considered just a tiny subtopic, one of many ways to try to probe the high redshift universe. But then it very quickly started to dominate the field as it does today. So, but first let's go to 2004. So in 2004, still reionization was considered the main topic in the whole field of high redshift and the first stars. Now there had been this a simulation by Nick Nedden in 2000, and I'm showing here one result of the simulation. This shows the mean free path of ionizing photons, which is the typical distance traveled by an ionizing photon from a galaxy before it gets absorbed by a hydrogen atom. So this is in co-moving megaparsecs as a function of time, or 1 plus redshift. So you see that during reionization, the typical mean free path, so you can think of it just as the typical size of H2 bubbles in the simulation. The H2 bubbles were typically about a tenth of a megaparsec, and only at the very end of reionization, when basically all the final amount of hydrogen atoms cleared away were ionized, the mean free path jumped to essentially infinity. And the reason I say infinity is that this was the size of the entire simulation box. Now, this was a very influential result. So, for example, in 2003, a number of people worked out the effect of reionization on the CMB, on the cosmic microwave background. And they said that, so it had been known that the cosmic microwave background can probe reionization, because once the universe is ionized again, some of the CMB photons scatter again through the electrons in the gas. And that leaves a signature on the CMB photon temperature through the kinetic Sunyaev-Zel'dovich effect, which is that says that because the electrons are moving towards us or away from us, when the photons scatter, it changes their energy distribution. So when calculating this, they assume basically this model, that the sizes of H2 bubbles is around 100 kiloparsec throughout reionization until the very, very end of this era. Okay, but in 2004, there was a simulation that went to that covered a bigger volume, so 15 megaparsec in the side. And they wrote that they found H2 bubbles up to a few megaparsec in size. So there was some confusion about what would be the typical size of the H2 bubbles. Now, there was also a second issue about reionization, a basic issue of what does reionization look like? What is a basic topology? So in 2000, a paper by these influential people said that in an inhomogeneous universe, reionization occurs outside in, which means starting in voids and gradually penetrating into overdense regions. So they predicted that the topology should be that you first ionize the low density gas, and only later, only at the end, you ionize the denser regions in the universe. And to Yeah, so the idea that there here was that there are more combinations in the dense regions, exactly. Now, to add to the confusion, this paper in 2003 was another simulation in a bigger box and also looking at two different regions in the universe. So an average region, which they called the field, and an overdense region, which they called the protocluster. And this in this simulation, they found that there is a significant difference in when each of these two regions reionizes. So they were seeing fluctuations on even larger scales, but they also supported this. They found the protocluster reionizes later than the field. Okay, so it turned out that this was a lot of confusion, and Avi Loeb and I in 2004 managed to resolve much of this based on a fairly simple idea, which is that galaxies at early times, at high redshift, are very strongly clustered or very strongly biased, is the other term people use. So the idea is that the galaxies at early times were very rare, and they corresponded to rare fluctuations. And that means that the number density of galaxies was very sensitive to small changes in the overall density. So if you increase the density by a little bit, like in this region, you get a much higher number density of galaxies, and therefore this region, the galaxies and the stars within it, fully reionize this region. While at the same time, a field region or a void region with a slight, which is slightly less dense than the mean, has a much smaller number of galaxies, and it's still mostly atomic hydrogen. And we also realized that this implies that, in fact, you expect overdense regions to reionize first because of this strong bias. So if even a small increase in density causes a huge increase in the number of galaxies and therefore in the number of ionizing photons, and this is a much larger effect than the increase in the number of combinations or the number of atoms that you have to ionize in the first place. And this was then verified. First, there was this nice model, which these people were able to analytically predict the distribution of sizes of H2 bubbles and showing that indeed you expect large bubbles of over 10 megaparsec. And then by 2006, a number of groups, this was the first group, they started running simulations. They realized they were forced to go to very large boxes, 100 megaparsec boxes, even though they couldn't resolve the galaxy so well. But the size of the box was more important to see that in reionization, you indeed expect very large bubbles of order tens of megaparsec sizes.
What was wrong with the previous results that seemed exactly the opposite, but it reionized outside in?
You could look at the different things. So the problem with this was mainly that the box was very small. Although, again, it was a limitation of simulation. So the other guys went to big boxes, but then they couldn't really resolve the galaxies that we expect to cause reionization. So it was a difficulty. I think there was some problem with the radius transfer. I don't know what, there was some error, I think. This was just an analytical model. So they had a nice analytical model that, in retrospect, people use it for what happens within an H2 bubble. So within an H2 bubble, you have like filaments or really high density things, which do remain neutral, more neutral than the rest. But you need the first step of actually ionizing photons reaching. So it turns out, you can think of it like a covering factor. So the ionizing photons in the dense regions can't reach out of those regions to get to the void. If they did, somehow they would ionize the void easily, but they don't. So they first have to ionize their surroundings, and then when they reach the void, and then when much of the volume is ionized, then this is a good description of the last remaining neutral gas, but not of the first stage.
The boundaries of ionized region,
yeah, they move very fast usually, sure. Yeah, which causes a bit of a difficulty, right? You have these shock fronts and the ionized front. It's a bit complicated. I mean, it's especially complicated. I mean, in simulation, if you want to know the temperature of the gas after the ionizing front goes by, it's very difficult because it goes fast, and there's a very rapid cooling for a very short amount of time during the ionization front. So
there is no mass transfer, but there is.
There's no mass transfer, right? It's like a wave going. That's right. Okay, so in order to continue, I need to say a few words about what processes determine the spin temperature of hydrogen gas and out there in the universe. So if we have a hydrogen atom out there, it, of course, is always surrounded by CMB photons. And if this scattering of CMB photons were the only interaction and the only energy exchange, it would drive the gas into thermal equilibrium with the CMB. So in particular, it would drive the spin temperature to the CMB temperature. Now, if this were the case, then we wouldn't be able to see anything, because the CMB is our foreground source in every direction. And if you want to see an absorber relative to the foreground, it can't be in thermal equilibrium with your background. So fortunately, there are other processes. For example, just collisions among the hydrogen atoms with each other. In these collisions, there are energy exchanges. And the typical energies are determined by the kinetic motion of the collision, the kinetic energy of the atom. So these energy exchanges tend to drive the spin temperature to the regular gas kinetic temperature. Now, in cosmology, the gas temperature is different usually from the CMB, again, because we're at very low densities and interaction rates are low. So the gas usually is colder than the CMB until eventually it's heated above the CMB. But as long as it's different from the CMB, there's something to see. However, as the universe expands and the density goes down, the collision rate goes down, and this effect actually becomes ineffective at around redshift 30. So to see at lower redshift than 30, to see something, you need a different effect. Fortunately, there is one. And it's called today the Wathausen field effect. It's a bit of a complicated atomic physics, which was first worked out in the 1950s. And only 50 years later became important in cosmology. So the idea of this is that there's an indirect interaction with Lyman alpha photons. So Lyman alpha is n equals 1 to n equals 2. It's around 10 electron volts. It's a much, much higher energy than what we're talking about. So it's an indirect coupling. The way it goes is that if there are Lyman alpha photons in the universe from any source, for example, stars, then when a photon hits a hydrogen atom in the ground state at n equals 1, it absorbs a photon, goes to n equals 2, and then eventually it goes back down to n equals 1. And when it comes back down, it can end up in a different hyperfine level than where it started. So that's how you get the mixing. Now, what happens is that each Lyman alpha photon in the universe, it scatters with many, many atoms, around a million. And in these scatterings, the Lyman alpha photon, there's a transfer of energy between the photons and the hydrogen atoms, and the hydrogen atoms, their motion is determined by the kinetic temperature. So as a result of this atomic physics, it actually drives the spin temperature to the kinetic temperature, to the gas temperature, and actually saves us from going to the CMB and allows us to see the hydrogen at low redshifts. Okay, so now we can talk about what happens beyond ionization or before ionization, and people today have this sexy name for this whole field called cosmic dawn. So sometimes it refers to beyond ionization, and sometimes it includes ionization as well. So this paper that I mentioned before, Madao et al. 97, they first considered these earlier times, and they realized that you expect two other major cosmic events, milestones that can be seen through this 21 centimeter, through these radio observations. So first, it turns out that you need a very low level of Lyman alpha radiation, of Lyman alpha intensity, to do this Wathausen field effect and to couple the spin temperature to the gas temperature. So this is, you expect this to be the first effect. When you just have a very low level of stars in the universe, of star formation, you have enough Lyman alpha to produce this. And then at maybe about the same time or somewhat later, you expect X-ray heating. So the emission rate depends on the temperature of the gas. So once it's heated, you will see that through this 21 centimeter observations. Now, X-rays, so they consider different things. Today we think pretty confidently that X-rays are the most likely way to heat the universe early on, because X-rays travel far in the universe even when it's still full of atoms and still neutral. And from all known sources, X-ray binaries are the most likely source, but there could be other, you know, surprising astrophysical sources. Now, in 97, when they did these first, pioneering study, they assumed that these intensity backgrounds would be very uniform in the universe. And the reason is that these Lyman alpha and X-ray photons travel very far. They can travel 100 megaparsecs in the universe before they get absorbed. And that means that you get smoothing on very large scales. So they expected things to be very uniform. Now, in 2005, so after Avi Loeb and I looked at this realization, and due to these to large fluctuations in the number density of galaxies, we argued that the H2 bubble should be quite large. We applied the same idea to this, and we realized that these fluctuations actually are not so small. So we specifically looked at the Lyman alpha fluctuations and found that they're quite large for basically two reasons. One is that even on 100 megaparsec scales, you get significant fluctuations in the number density of galaxies, because the galaxies are so rare that they are very strongly clustered, very strongly biased. So even though the underlying density fluctuations are small, the fluctuations in the number of galaxies are much larger. But the other factor is that some of these Lyman alpha and X-ray photons don't travel so far. I mean, some do get to 100 megaparsec, but some don't, and gives you stronger fluctuations. So this today is considered to be basically the highest redshift signal that we can detect in the foreseeable future from early stars. So this might come somewhere between redshift 20 and 30. And then Pritchard and Frolinetto, a couple years later, applied a similar idea to the X-ray case. It's a little bit complicated because you have to calculate the X-ray heating. You have to calculate, first of all, the X-ray intensity and the fluctuations in that, and then integrate over time to get the temperature fluctuations, and then this affects 21 centimeter fluctuations. But it's a similar idea, and the effect is of similar size. So hopefully each of these eras can be seen through fluctuations and not just through the global the global things that happen to the universe. Because both of these types of effects are being tried, are there attempts to observe them, both the global change in the emission of, in the universe, but also the spatial fluctuation. And the fluctuations you can see with interferometers, that these are two very different kind of observations. I would say it's not completely clear which will succeed first. I mean, looking at the global effect on the sky means just taking a simple antenna, measuring the total radio emission in the sky as a function of frequency, which corresponds to a function of redshift. But you have many fewer lever arms to play with. So you're just observing the whole sky, and you're hoping that there's nothing in the antenna and the receiver that produces any frequency structure. And then the changes with frequency that you see, you hope correspond to actually all these changes in the emission of the universe. But yeah, so there are a lot of foregrounds, and the idea is that the foregrounds are supposed to be very, very smooth in frequency, because all the foregrounds come from synchrotron emission, which has a smooth spectrum. So that's the basic idea, and maybe it will work. I mean, with interferometers, you have much more freedom. First of all, you can point your telescope, you can look at the region of the sky where the galaxy is much quieter than on average. You don't have to look at the whole sky. You can look for point sources and remove them from your data. You have a lot more to play with. So I think so neither of them has made a detection yet. But so I think the fluctuations are a sure bet. But maybe the global thing can work as well. We'll have to see. Okay. So as I mentioned, in each direction you in whatever direction you look, you have this cosmic microwave background as your background source. So this is different from other kinds of absorption studies where you actually have to find bright sources to be your background. So that's convenient that the whole sky has a background source. Now, when you look at the CMB, of course, it has a Planck spectrum. And the spectrum of the CMB peaks at around 2 millimeters. Now here we're talking about 21 centimeters. And actually it's not 21 centimeters, it's redshifted to maybe 2 meters. So anyway, it's a very, very long wavelength compared to the CMB. It's a very, very small frequency. So it's way down here in the Rayleigh-Jeans regime of the black body. So in this regime, the intensity of the Planck law looks like this. And in this subject, we use the language of radio astronomers, where they use this equation to define an effective temperature called the brightness temperature and measure the intensity of the emission in the sky in units of temperature. Okay, so here will be usually millikelvins. So again, this is a 21 centimeter line. We look at some direction, we get light from the CMB, which has some flux represented here just by a straight line. And then if along the line of sight there are hydrogen clouds, you know, clouds of hydrogen atoms along the line of sight, each atom absorbs at its particular redshift, so 21 centimeters times 1 plus z. And then when you look on, in your lab as a function of wavelengths, you see the whole line of sight just as with any other atomic line combined with cosmological redshift. So the redshift, therefore frequency or wavelengths, gives you the line of sight direction. The CMB covers the sky, gives you the two dimensions on the sky. And together, the promise of this field is to be the first three-dimensional imaging method of the low density gas in the universe, at least, you know, at high redshift when most of the gas was still hydrogen atoms. So as I mentioned, there are many experiments. So here, well, I'm just showing the fluctuation experiments. There are a number of global experiments as well. So the fluctuation experiments are big interferometers. Usually so for example, the MWA, the European one, the LOFAR, it consists of a very large number of simple antennas all put together digitally as if they're one big interferometer. So basically LOFAR and PAPER, which is a US experiment also with Australians. So this is located in Australia, like the MWA. So LOFAR and PAPER basically are competing most vigorously to see which of them maybe over the next couple of years, maybe we'll be able to make the first detection from cosmic reionization. But there's already a lot of, so even though the detection hasn't occurred yet because the foregrounds are really bright and difficult, we're already looking forward. So it looks like the square kilometer array is going to actually be built within around 5 years. And I'm part of the science team for the Cosmic Dawn epoch of reionization part. So hopefully this will happen. This will also be in Australia and it should go way beyond just initial detections, as I will show you. So let me give you an idea. So I have a clock. Let me give you a basic idea of what we hope the SKA will be able to detect. So there's a lot of stuff on this plot. I will slowly describe it. So what I'm showing here is the power spectrum of fluctuations described in units of millikelvin squared. It's basically the variance of the fluctuation of intensity in units of millikelvin. So it's millikelvin squared. And on various scales, so k is the wave number. So here is k in units of inverse megaparsecs. And different curves show different scales. So k.03 is large scales. And if you go to small scales, you get larger fluctuations in cosmology. And this is shown as a function of 1 plus z, so covering a very wide range of time, cosmic times and redshifts. And this is roughly the expected sensitivity to the power spectrum of the SKA1, which is going to be built in hopefully in 5 years, and maybe in 10 years will produce nice results. And eventually people hope to go on to SKA2 and get even better sensitivity. Okay, and so these are various theoretical curves from models, and what we're showing are different stages of the universe. So let's start from early time. So above redshift 30, is basically the dark ages. So the first stars have already formed by redshift 65 or so, but there are not yet enough stars to affect this signal. So this is basically basic fundamental cosmology, the primordial background. You can see that this background is very low. The SKA actually cuts off at around redshift 28. Even if it went beyond it, this signal is very low. So this is actually represents the promising far future of the field. because this can do basic cosmology that in many ways is better than the CMB, but you can see that it's in the far future. But in the for the next decade, we're talking about this part of the universe, which is not fundamental physics so much, it's fundamental cosmology, but it's a lot of new astrophysics that we have not probed before. So basically the first stars. So the first big signal you expect are the Laman alpha fluctuations that I mentioned before, and you can see it gives you a big peak when you rise to, first to the level, when you have enough Laman alpha photons to couple the spin temperature to the gas temperature. And then as the Laman alpha intensity goes, you know, keep going up, this it actually saturates and the fluctuations go down. Then you expect X-ray heating. And then you have actually, in this paper we showed that because X-ray binaries have a fairly hard X-ray spectrum, you actually expect heating to occur. So when you have a hard X-ray spectrum, you have a high energy X-rays of a few kV, they actually travel far in the universe. And as they travel, they redshift, they lose a lot of the energy. So the heating actually occurs fairly late. And it's more uniform than people expected before, assuming a softer X-ray spectrum. So you have the heating era, and actually if you look at different scales, so large scale and small scale, some of them have a heating peak. If you get a heating peak, if you're looking at scales that are so large that the X-ray photons don't reach such scales. But if you look at smaller scales, smaller than where you get X-ray smoothing, then you actually don't get a peak, you get a kind of minimum. And that happens, that actually marks a heating transition, which is the point where the mean gas temperature in the low density universe goes above the CMB temperature for the first time. So that's called the heating transition. So you can see all of these things, they probe the spectrum of the X-ray sources, whatever they are, and this milestone, which is heating the gas in the universe. And then finally, you have these redshifts. This is the realization era. So you have a peak of realization, which is due to large fluctuations coming from the H2 bubbles. Okay, and then eventually, at the end of realization, you ionize all the hydrogen, it's all gone, and the signal goes to zero, and this era basically ends. I mean, what's not shown here is that there's some hydrogen, a little bit of hydrogen left, you know, hydrogen atoms left within galaxies, and people actually hope to use that as well, so that's not shown here. But that's more like a galaxy survey. Using hydrogen. Okay, so the next question is, suppose 10 years from now I come back to you with all of these curves, say in this region, but actually showing data points from the SKA. This will be really remarkable. We will learn a lot about early galaxies that we don't know today. But you might be a little bit skeptical. You might say, you know, I will show you all of these data points. Of course, it won't look so nice. There'll be some error bars. And then I will say, you know, I fit them to this model that includes all of these different processes, and this is what I learned. Here you have some type of galaxies, here there you have some type of X-ray source, and so on. So you may not be happy that, you may not be satisfied that, we invested €1 billion in the SKA. It's not only for this, but this is one major motivating factor for the SKA1. We invested €1 billion. Is it really enough to just have all of these data points that you need to fit to all of these complicated models? Or do you want something more? So what more can you ask? So you might say that you want a clearer proof, not just this kind of a black box of fitting these power spectrum curves to a bunch of models. So what can you do better? Well, basically, if you ask me for proof, there are two good answers I can give you. So this is one type of answer. But probably an even better answer is to look for what I would call model-independent signatures. So this is one thing that I've been thinking about recently. So looking for signatures in the signal that are so clear that you don't need all of this parameter fitting to recognize. So everybody will recognize that we know basically what we've seen and what we're talking about. So I want to briefly describe one example, one major example of a model-independent signature that will make us much more confident both to ourselves and in terms of convincing others that we know what we've seen. Yeah.
So I can be even more impressed. How many model parameters go into those curves that you were showing us? I mean, is that a very complicated model? Is this something that needs drastic simplification, I believe, or what?
Well, so because of the SKA, but for the first time, a lot of different theorists that we're organizing to try to answer these questions. So we haven't quite done it yet. I would say in these parameters, there are around 6 parameters, I would say, having to do with the galaxies, like the minimum mass of galaxies, star formation efficiency, X-ray efficiency. So it depends a little bit how you count. And then there's a whole other question of how robust or how reliable the results are for a given set of parameters. So, because you have simulations which have their difficulties and you have all kinds of approaches. So we're still not quite there yet, but I think we're reasonably confident that on these large scales, because these are cosmological scales which average over a lot of what happens on small scale. So hopefully things are reasonably good, but we haven't completely demonstrated that yet, I would say. Yeah.
Regarding the inhomogeneity subscale, which you really should set in, you have to model this in the dense, not the dense region.
No, so we model all of that. I mean, we know that from the CMB, we know what the density fluctuations look like on all scales. And then we model them, you form a number of galaxies and you can calculate how much X-rays do you integrate around each point to see what X-ray intensity it sees from all the other galaxies forming around. So no, we calculate all that in kind of numerical simulations. I mean, sometimes full numerical simulations, sometimes there's some approximations because simulations can't cover the full range of scales, but essentially we can say that we're calculating this and we don't need to do any assumptions.
What about observational data? These are models. Models of inhomogeneity.
So it all goes for, the basic galaxy formation basically we know very well, right? So we have the cosmic micro background and then we have galaxy surveys, which is the second part of my talk, but so at low redshift, which are consistent with that. So galaxy formation and the fluctuations in the number of galaxies is something that is very well known because you can base it on, you have the initial condition and the final condition. So we're interpolating in the middle, but the main uncertainties are more the astrophysics of what are the how much X-rays do you get, and how much star formation can you form in small galaxies, because most of the galaxies then were small, so conditions were significantly different from what we see today. So it's more astrophysical uncertainties, but the basic distribution of densities and halos we know about. So what happens within the galaxies are the main things that we will see. Okay, so just briefly, whenever you measure anything, position through redshift or through absorption at a given frequency, you have something called redshift space distortions. So in the context of galaxy surveys, this is called the Kaiser effect. So you can think of it as a simple example. If you have a slab of hydrogen, which is not moving at some place, then all of this hydrogen will absorb at the same frequency compared to us when light passes through it, and we will think that there's a huge density of hydrogen at that particular frequency, that particular redshift, but really it's a slab along line of sight. It's just because it's not moving, it seems to us to be all at one position. So the velocity of hydrogen, velocity of gas, is actually affects what you think is the density of gas when you do these absorption measurements. So what happens in general is that you get an isotropy, a dependence on the angle between the line of sight and the K vector in Fourier space when you measure the power spectrum fluctuations. So if you let mu be the cosine of this angle, then Avi Loeb and I showed that in the case of 21 centimeter fluctuations, instead of the normal isotropic power spectrum that is just the sum total of all the all the sources of 21 centimeter fluctuations, you actually expect in linear perturbation theory to measure a polynomial in this mu squared, where mu is this cosine of the angle, which has several terms which you can measure separately and get a lot more information than just one power spectrum. So in particular, what I will focus on here is that there's one term that measures the coarse correlation between density fluctuations and all the sources of 21 centimeter fluctuations. So in this recent paper, we showed that this term, so what I'm showing here is just the mu squared term, again in the same unit, so millikelvin squared, the variance, but only the portion which is this this main anisotropic term. So what we did is we compared the predicted term based on this simple equation that I showed you, assuming that in linear theory you can actually separate out these terms, compared to an attempt to measure this term from a simulation, which include various nonlinearities. So this separation is not exact. So you can see that that at least, you know, when you look at it like this in a log scale, the two things agree pretty well. And actually, this is shown as a function, again, of 1 plus redshift. So this is the measured frequency. So this actually shows that you can trace these different periods in the cosmic, in the evolution of the universe through this. And I think in some ways it's more modeling dependent than just the power spectrum. I mean, it's complementary, but it's more modeling dependent in the sense that this term is sometimes positive and negative. It actually switches sign. So the solid regions are the positive regions. So somehow switching sign seems to me a clearer signature than just changing shape of a power spectrum.
But switching sign also corresponds to emission versus absorption?
No. Yes, but you can never know that directly, right? Because this is only fluctuation. So we don't directly, but in one case it does, yeah. So as I'll explain in a second. So for example, early on in the Lyman alpha era, if you have more density, remember this term in the linear regime measures the cross correlation of 21 centimeter fluctuation with density. So early on, when you have more density, you have more galaxies, you have more Lyman alpha, and you have more stronger signals. So this is positive. And during reionization, where you have more galaxies, you actually have less hydrogen. So this should be negative because you're ionizing the hydrogen. And during the heating era, actually, as you mentioned, so this should actually switch sign during the heating transition. When the gas goes from colder than the CMB and absorption to hotter and emission, yeah. So this should also be seen. So all of these changes of signs are very clear, kind of a cosmic clock that shows you the different cosmic eras. Yeah.
So does something like JDRST give you enough galaxies to do this with future 21 centimeters to do the cross correlation?
No. This is measuring the close correlation. That's a separate issue which I'm looking at, but. The answer to what you said is no, not from JWST, because JWST has a tiny field of view, and you need, these are degree scales, you need many galaxies, but maybe not JWST, maybe WFIRT or something with, you know, if you have Lyman alpha surveys. I mean, JWST, I think you just have, the field of view is too tiny. But what I'm talking here is not cross-correlating with galaxies, just within the signal itself, if you just measure the power spectrum including its anisotropy and not measuring over, not averaging over angles, then this term gives you this cross correlation just from within the 21 centimeter signal itself. Okay, but I want to leave a little bit of time for part two, which is more about a low redshift observation. So in this case, but it's related to high redshift, as you'll see. So here the question that I want to ask is whether baryons follow the dark matter. So in general, of course, no, there are all kinds of physical effects on baryons. But more interesting question is whether baryons might follow the dark matter on very large cosmological scales. And the answer there is still no. And the reason is cosmic recombination. So basically before recombination, you had the photons undergoing sound waves, acoustic oscillations. You had the dark matter, which didn't care much. The dark matter only cares about gravity. So the dark matter was already starting to accumulate in around over densities. But the ordinary baryons, the gas was ionized. So due to the scattering of electrons with the photons, the gas was following the photons in the sound waves until cosmic recombination, when hydrogen atoms formed and the atoms are neutral, so they forgot about the photons and started falling towards the dark matter due to the gravity. So this leaves an imprint. So at recombination, the baryons had been following the photons and they were distributed differently from the dark matter. And it turns out this has many different consequences. So let's look first at what happens at high redshift. So what I'm showing here is the ratio of the baryon perturbations to dark matter perturbations on different scales in terms of wave number, and a huge range of different wave numbers. Down here is the gas temperature over baryons, but let's leave this aside. So let's just look here. How differently are the baryons? How different are the baryon density fluctuations compared to those in the dark matter? And this is shown as a function of redshift. So redshift 400, 120. You can see that as you go to low redshift, baryons are catching up with the dark matter due to the gravity, but they never catch up completely. Now, I want to emphasize here that there are several different scales in terms of the physics. So the larger scales is outside the horizon. Here, the baryons always follow the dark matter because no other physics can have an effect, a causal effect. Within the horizon, you have these scales, which are the BAOs, the baryon acoustic oscillations. So here you have these oscillations due to the sound waves in the baryons that were not in the dark matter. So you get these oscillations in the relative difference between them. Then if you go to somewhat smaller scales, then again, the baryons at any given redshift are less clustered, you have smaller fluctuations than dark matter, but the ratio here is a constant. So I'll call this the large structure regime. It's all the large scales, but smaller than the BAOs. So significantly smaller than 100 megaparsecs is this large structure regime. And finally, the small scales are the genes or filtering scales. This is a scale where the gas pressure, due to its temperature, so the pressure prevents the gas from falling gravity, from falling into dark matter densities, and therefore you have this suppression. Okay, so with Avi Loeb in 2011, we realized that this might have a consequence even for redshift zero, for local galaxies. And the idea is to look at the varying gas fraction in galaxies that you expect as a result of this effect. So we wrote this paper, Scale-Dependent Bias of Galaxies from BAOs. The basic logic is that since you expect the gas to dark matter ratio to vary spatially on large scales, then if you have some regions would have more gas compared to the dark matter. In those regions, when you form halos, you expect there to be a larger fraction of gas within the halos. More gas, you expect on average to produce more stars and have more luminosity compared to the mass, or lower mass to light ratio. So this is a general idea, but more quantitatively, the point is that you know from linear perturbation theory, you can predict the pattern, the spatial pattern of the baryon to dark matter perturbations. Or really, we're interested in the baryon to the total matter. The total matter, you know, average between the baryons and dark matter, is what determines gravity, and the baryon fluctuations have a different pattern. But the same pattern with some magnitude, at some level, should be reflected in the luminosity to mass distribution of galaxies. Okay, well, let's start with the fluctuations themselves. So this shows how different are the baryon fluctuations from the total in relative units. So R of K is the fractional difference in the baryon perturbations. So this focuses on scales which are the BAOs, and then going to the constant, which we call the large scale structure. So R LSS is a constant value that this reaches on these scales. R of K is negative because baryons are less strongly clustered than the total matter. So you can see that redshift 6 is about a 2% effect, and then it goes down at roughly as 1 plus z. So at low redshift, it's still around a 0.5% effect. But it turns out that it's amplified. And when I was writing this paper with Avi Loeb, coincidentally, I was at the same time working on a paper with my former student, Smadar Naoz, where we were interested in a very different issue. We were actually looking at high redshifts and looking at the gas depletion, the missing amount of gas within halos compared to the cosmic baryon density. But we were focusing on small halos where the genes mass has an effect, and we're looking at what halos do you have missing gas. But I when we were working on this paper, I realized that in this simulation, we also had some very massive halos that are far too large to be affected by pressure. But even in those halos, we found that there was some missing gas. And when I plotted this as a function of redshift, I saw that it goes down with redshift roughly as 1 plus d, as you expect from RLSS. But there's a factor of about 3, so different. So there seems to be an amplification of this effect And you expect something like that due to the nonlinear process of halo formation. So when you have halo collapse in a nonlinear, the nonlinear collapse, it's hard to predict exactly what would happen. There seems to be an amplification, and this is just one set of simulations. We need more simulations to check this effect, but this seems to be a verification of this basic idea, and showing a bit of an amplification, which is important. So I don't want to show too many equations, just the basic result, just these two equations. The idea is when you actually measure the distribution of galaxies, if you look at the number density of galaxies and measure relative fluctuations on different scales, the usual assumption is that this reflects the distribution of underlying the total matter density fluctuations with some bias, some linear bias. And then our idea was to also measure the luminosity density. So just take the number density of galaxies and multiply by their luminosities, and then measure the fluctuation in the luminosity of galaxies. Then you expect a similar term, but you also expect some dependence on, so we call this BL delta, the dependence, it's some bias factor that measures the dependence of luminosity of galaxies on the overall difference between the baryons and total matter in the region from which these galaxies form. And this is the result you get. So you get a different spatial pattern, not delta tot, but multiplied by this R of K factor. So our paper actually didn't attract much attention, but hopefully now it will, with this PRL coming out, where we made the first attempt to search for this effect in the SDSS3 BOSS data. And as a result of this work, as part of this work, we realized that if this effect is detected, it would be more important than what Avi and I originally realized. So what Avi and I noted about the importance of this effect is that if you can measure this BL delta, you would be probing a novel aspect of galaxy formation, of how the luminosity of galaxies reflects the overall baryon fraction in the surrounding region. That's interesting, but when we were working on this, we realized that there are more important consequences. So if you can measure this, it will be comparable to the bullet cluster. So here's the famous bullet cluster, where basically two clusters have collided. And you can see that the dark matter represented in blue, which is measured through gravitational lensing, the dark matter and the galaxies basically went through each other and they're far apart. And the gas, through X-rays seen in red, basically collided, shocked, and is separated by a smaller distance. So if you can measure this, it would be like a bullet cluster, because it would be probing the difference in the distribution of dark matter and baryons, which, of course, if dark matter doesn't exist, it would be hard to produce that difference. But it would also be in linear theory and very large scale. So in some ways, it would be harder to argue with than with a bullet cluster, which involves nonlinear complexity. And the third importance would be to constrain a type of perturbation called CIPs. So when you look at different density perturbations, you have the usual perturbation from inflation, which are called adiabatic, in which you maintain a constant ratio of the densities of different different contributions to matter, different matter components like dark matter, baryons, photons, neutrinos. All of them are perturbed in the same way, with keeping the same ratio of their densities. If the perturbations are not adiabatic, then they're called isocurvature, and you have different types. So CIPs are a particular type, which is very hard to constrain, called compensated isocurvature perturbations. So here you change the ratio of dark matter to baryons, but in a balanced way. So where you have more dark matter, you have less baryons, and you maintain the same total density distribution. And since gravity depends only on the total density, making a change in this way affects very few things. But of course, it affects this if you're directly measuring the baryon to dark matter ratio. So right now, the situation with CIPs is that the best limit comes from the baryon fraction of clusters, so the total fraction of baryons in terms of the cluster mass. It doesn't vary much between clusters, so it gives you about an 8% variation as an upper limit. And there's also a separate limit from the CMB, which is comparable. Okay, so let's last couple of minutes, I'll show our results. So what's shown here is a correlation function. So I meant to mention that This work was led by Jan Sumaniak, who was a graduate student of Ofer Lahav, and now is a postdoc at Weizmann at the Weizmann Institute in Israel. So this is the correlation function measured for galaxy density or for galaxy luminosity in yellow, multiplied by distance squared, separation squared, just for this plot. So you see our data point and best fit models. Now, it's a little bit hard to judge this kind of a plot because these points are, both different distances are correlated between them, but especially the number density and luminosity density points are highly correlated because they come from the same galaxies. So actually, the difference between these two correlation functions is measured much more accurately than each of them separately. So I'll show the difference in a minute. But first, let me just show the main result, which is the distribution of this BL delta number, which corresponds to the new effect, the dependence of L on the difference in baryon and dark matter distributions. So this comes from MCMC fitting to the data. So you can see that the BL delta is measured to be non-zero. So zero would mean that there is no measured effect. And actually, it's measured statistically fairly clearly to be non-zero. So it's measured to be greater than 0.4 at about 3.2 sigma. You know, there are a few points down here. If you're more generous and you say that we don't know whether BL delta is positive, we expect it to be positive, but maybe there are all kinds of feedback effects. Maybe having more baryons actually causes less luminosity. So you allow it to be also negative, and you only require that it be non-zero. So it's measured to be non-zero at closer to 4 sigma. And with this, you also get a limit on CIPs, although it's somewhat worse than the best current limits. However, we're not quite ready to declare victory here, because let me show you the most important figure, which is the difference between the two correlation functions. Again, measured times distance squared. So this shows the data points, and this shows different models. So here there are actually two different models that are almost the same, which is a model without these weird CIP perturbations, but either without or with this new BL delta effect. And you can see that without the CIPs, there are actually no measured BL delta effect. And it's measured only when you allow the CIPs as well, then you get a very different best fit. So it's a bit of a problem. BL delta is a new effect that we expect to be there. CIP is a very speculative effect that we don't expect to be there. And the two are completely coupled because you only measure CIPs if BL delta is non-zero. So it makes it very hard. And in fact, the reason we're not there yet is because the results are not robust. So one way to see that is to take different number of bins. So these here we had 31 spatial bins. Here's 21, so there are fewer data points and the error bars are smaller. And here you can see more clearly that the model, the complete model, doesn't really describe the data so well here. It describes it here where not having CIPs fails, but this may be something having to do with systematic differences between the data and the models. I mean, this is a very large scale. It's the 100 megaparsec scales, the BAO scales, which are the major where all the action is supposed to be. So we don't quite believe our results yet. So I'll summarize, as part of the summary of the talk, I'll summarize what we think we have shown. So to summarize the talk, in the first part, I talked about cosmic dawn, which hopefully will be seen in the next decades with 21st century cosmology. So I highlighted a few of my own contributions with Avi Loeb initially in 2004. We first showed that you have large fluctuations in the number of galaxies, which cause reionization to occur with large H2 bubbles. And this is very important because if the H2 bubbles were a tenth of a megaparsec, it would be hopeless to see those fluctuations because you would need very high resolution. And then in 2005, we showed that you also expect significant fluctuation from the Lyman alpha intensity at early times around redshift 20 or 25. And also this other thing, the power spectrum anisotropy, which leads to a nice model independent way to confirm that we know what we're seeing. I mentioned in passing, we had this paper showing that X-ray binaries actually have, because their X-ray spectrum is hard, you expect cosmic heating to occur possibly late, even overlapping with reionization. So it might be relevant to even the ongoing observations. And finally, this led to this power spectrum anisotropy as a model-independent signature. Okay, now the second part two was whether baryons follow dark matter. So we had this paper in 2011 arguing that you should look for galaxy clustering, for difference between clustering by luminosity or by galaxy number. And in this latest work, we've shown that current data are close to detection. You should be able to detect this at a few sigma if you can be sure that to get over all the systematic problems and what the correlation function looks like. So in principle, you can confirm standard cosmological model if you see this. But so despite the three sigma evidence, we're not claiming that we've done this. But we are claiming that there's going to be a lot better data soon. So hopefully this can be done. So thanks for listening.
In your work on the last part to do with baryons and dark matter, you assume that Newtonian gravity and chain relativity are correct in these large scales.
Yeah. No, absolutely. So that's why I'm saying this is why it's important, because it's a particular pattern that is assumes not only, assumes all of the standard models, the standard GR on large scales and the standard interpretation in terms of dark matter, all of that would receive a very nice confirmation if you can detect this. So we are not there yet, but the community is hearing about this basically for the first time, and people will now start to think about the best ways to detect this. I mean, if it's detected, it would be a big challenge to any non-standard theory to produce the same pattern. But if it's detected, so we have to be a little more patient.
In the case of the bullet cluster, there's something called a train wreck cluster.
Okay.
People 520. And they've seen the dark kappa laser sheet which was sent with the gas in public.
Right.
And so there's some issues here.
Right. So that's why I said. So in the nonlinear case, there are also some of the people with the non-standard models claim that they can explain the bullet cluster in their model. So I think in the linear theory in the linear theory on the one hand would be indirect because it's through the galaxy distribution, but in some ways would be a clearer, more robust evidence. So yeah, I agree. Because of nonlinear complexities, the bullet cluster. I'm just saying it's very famous, but it doesn't completely solve the problem. Sure.
Can these 21 centimeter observations be used to put limits on the growth of supermassive black holes? I know you're not mentioning them there, but it's sort of too late for them to be the ionization source.
Of supermassive black holes?
Yeah, I'm just thinking about sort of like pre-AGN almost. Thinking like if you've got quasars at redshift 6 and 7, presumably they've been growing at some point.
Yeah, sure. So on quasars, pre-quasars. So, in that sense, we call them mini quasars, and they could be what heated the universe. So if you had a significant number of mini quasars, you would produce a lot of X-rays, and that actually is a big part of it, of seeing the cosmic heating era. So that should tell us,
star formation, the X-ray binding is designed.
Yeah, so
growing pre-supermassive.
Sure, so The X-ray spectra of mini quasars and X-ray binaries are expected to be not so different. So it would be hard to tell that difference. But it depends on what the quasars look like. I mean, the X-ray binaries, at least from low redshift observations, we expect them basically to follow star formation. And mini quasars, at least large quasars, supermassive black holes, seem to not quite form, not quite follow star formation. There seems to be a steeper relation between the mass of the black hole and the mass of the galaxy. It's not proportional. So if that continues to high redshift, it would give you a different redshift distribution. But anyway, you surely, any X-ray source, and this is one major one, but it's completely unknown in the sense that these are very different galaxies, very tiny, very high density, so very different from today. And we really don't know whether there are mini quasars or not. But if you take if you take just the low redshift, basically Magorian relation, relation with the galaxy size, and if you extrapolate to high redshift, you find that many quasars are not negligible. So at redshift 7 or 8, they can be comparable to extra binaries, and at higher redshift than that, they should be small if they're indeed very small in the small galaxies. But maybe they're not, so absolutely is the answer, yeah.
One other comment: the most distant galaxy we've seen is a redshift of 10, 9.
Well, yeah, they're different planets. I mean, it's a 10. I think recently even 11 or something.
11.
Was some claim. Yeah.
The latest.
I think so. Yeah.
So they're very hard to detect.
Yeah, that's why. So 20 centimeter cosmology. It not only will be able to detect things at very high redshift, but in this case where you're detecting things through the radiation field in the universe, you're sensitive to whatever produces most of the star formation. And even if it's very tiny galaxies which cannot be detected at all, you see the dominant population through this. So JWST will overlap somewhat, but it can only at best see some of the very, very brightest galaxies at the same time.
So yeah. We also have to have time to produce them.
Yeah, no, that's why you expect the galaxies to be very small. But again, for example, for the Lyman alpha, again, if you take any kind of model, you get around redshift 20 or something, these effects, because you need a very low level of Lyman alpha to produce this atomic physics effect. So this signal should be there, hopefully. Unless some weird things happen, if you get very early, very high, very strong heating somehow before Lyman alpha, then it can take away some of these signals. But that would be very strange, basically.
Any other questions? Or, again?